as we develop our meditation practice, that we're using particular methods, techniques, mindfulness of breathing, we could be developing metta bhavana, loving kindness meditation, could be using mindfulness of breathing in a variety of ways, a variety of techniques, but we use that as a basis for developing the continuity of attention and awareness, to be able to help to settle the mind and to allow the mind to become more clear, more steady. As we do that, we do need to pay attention to the content of the mind, the mood of the mind, the things that come in and come out of the mind, not in a over psychologizing it, but recognizing what is it that's helpful and beneficial for that process of settling. What is it that's obstructive? What gets in the way? So that the, paying attention to a category of phenomena that the Buddha classifies as hindrances, is recognizing, are they present, are they not present? If they're present, how to work with them? If they're not present, how to not fall under their sway? These are ways of directing our attention in practice. And I think it's important that we're willing to willing to investigate, willing to look clearly at the mind and assess one, what the state is, and what its needs are. What does the mind actually need? Not in a personal way, but in looking at it in terms of the opportunity of having a clear and spacious mind is available and possible to us. And it's a, in terms of, an aspect of nature, that's a, when the mind is clear and still and spacious, it's a highly agreeable state of being. It's like having, for most people, like if you go outside, it's a clear sunny day, it feels different than when it's cloudy and drizzly. It just feels different. It's the same with our mind, when we can attend to the mind in a way that fosters its clarity and spaciousness, brightness. It feels a lot different than when we let it get cluttered and clouded and complicated. So to just recognizing that as a natural phenomena of nature. When the Buddha describes hindrances, is a very simple statement in that the hindrances are those which overcome awareness and weaken discernment. That's a lovely description of how it works. Awareness, mindfulness, clarity gets overwhelmed, and then our discernment and wisdom is weakened. So that when we can undermine and relinquish those things which are hindrances, then we're fostering awareness, fostering mindfulness, and shoring up our discernment and wisdom. It's a natural process. Because the hindrances that the Buddha points to are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, sloth and drowsiness, restlessness and anxiety, and uncertainty or doubt. These are I think one of the these lists of the Buddha's teachings, what I see them as are templates for investigating experience. So that as we're sitting and meditating or doing walking meditation or practicing directing attention, we can lift up a particular template and see, is this what is occurring or not? Five hindrances, seven factors of enlightenment is another template, different flavor. And the hindrances, and there are these factors of awakening, paying attention, drawing attention to them. Four Noble Truths, five focuses of the grasping mind. These are templates for investigating experience, that in particularly in terms of that settling and clarifying of the mind, it's helpful and necessary to be able to clear the mind of the hindrances, this sensual desire, ill will, sloth and drowsiness, restlessness, anxiety, uncertainty, doubt. These are habits of mind that set up agitation or inability to see clearly. Actually, the Buddha at one point pointed to the like in the teaching on dependent origination, these 12 links of a chain of dependent origination, beginning at ignorance, avijja, lack of true knowledge, and then going through the series of internal and external contact with the senses and leading to desire, attachment, becoming, birth, old age, sickness, death, suffering, sort of through that 12-fold link to the arising of all the various types of suffering, dissatisfaction. And the Buddha, in one discourse, points to that, because sometimes it feels like ignorance is a base condition. That's like foundational of our human experience, and it keeps just repeating itself, ending up in suffering over and over again. And but the Buddha, in this discourse, points to ignorance also being avijja, lack of true knowledge, being a conditioned phenomenon. It arises because of conditions. And it points to the five hindrances as the fundamental condition for the supporting and the arising of avijja, of ignorance, lack of true knowledge. So that whenever we're directly willing to challenge and work with those hindrances, then we're very directly undermining that the quality of avijja, of ignorance, and thereby giving us the opportunity to establish, rather than the link of avijja, we've got the link, the foundation of vijja, of true knowledge, is always accessible to us. And that changes the whole patterns of the conditioning process. So that to these five hindrances are not... it's interesting as we explore the teachings, you think, well, you know, five hindrances... You go to a meditation retreat, they give a talk on the five hindrances, usually the first day or two, and then that's, you know, you get your basics of the... so you can get a bit of peaceful meditation. But if you take any teaching, and particularly, say, even the five hindrances, take any teaching, it leads one into liberation, understanding, true wisdom. This is something that I remember Ajahn Chah saying one time, that it doesn't matter where you pick up the teachings, you pick them up at generosity or dana, you pick them up at Four Noble Truths and dependent origination, it doesn't really matter where you pick those teachings up, all the rest of the teachings come with it. It's like if I just pulled on a corner of the shrine cloth here, all the rest of the shrine's going to come with it. So that I won't do that. I won't illustrate my point that clearly. And so that wherever we pick up the teachings, all the rest of the teachings follow along. So that, and I think that's a really good example of the five hindrances, where if we pay attention to the five hindrances, we're directly giving ourselves an opportunity for a relinquishing of avijja, and grounding ourselves very directly and immediately in the opportunity of accessing true knowledge, this fundamental clear awareness that understands and sees the true nature of things. And so, you know, picking up these the investigation of the hindrances. One of the discourses that the Buddha gives about the five hindrances, there's a the image that he uses is the image of gold, and whenever there's there's these five impurities to gold, and when any of those five impurities are present in gold, then that gold is not pliant, not malleable, not luminous. And that's the phrase that I really, really like, in the sense that, and then when those impurities of gold are taken out, then that gold is pliant, it's malleable, it's luminous. And so it's in the same way, the mind is similar. Because when the Buddha uses the five impurities of iron, copper, tin, lead, silver, and then the five impurities of the mind are similar. When there's these five impurities present, then the mind is not pliant, not malleable, not luminous. But when those five impurities of the mind are relinquished, are dealt with skillfully, then the mind is, it's pliant, it's malleable, it's luminous. And so that working with those hindrances, identifying, paying attention to them, not in a way of, oh, there I go again, I'm quite, here I am, me the meditator who always gets ill will or always gets sloth and torpor. I mean, it's not identifying with it personally, but it's recognize, okay, that's a natural phenomena of mind. Occurs. We all have them in various degrees and ways, shapes, and forms. But how to work with it? And when we do identify and recognize it, take an interest in finding skillful means for relinquishing, letting go, or countering those hindrances, then the mind starts to access those qualities of being pliant, being malleable, being luminous, and allowing the mind to access that. Giving the mind that opportunity, giving the heart that opportunity to dwell in those soft and bright qualities. One of the discourses that the Buddha gives is on the theme of feeding and starving, the hindrances and the factors of awakening, that quality of how do we feed or nourish something? Are we feeding or nourishing the hindrances? Can we just not feed them, starve them? It's like, if at your home you get some sort of stray cat comes along, and some scruffy, great stray cat, and I don't like them. So, I mean, some people really like them, or some stray dog, and you put out some food for them, and put out a dish of water, and they're going to come back. You've got yourself a friend for life. So in the same way, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, anxiety, uncertainty, doubt, they sort of show up in the mind, and you take an interest in them, feed them, pet them. They're going to hang around. So that it's just the act of recognizing and then not feeding them, not encouraging, not nourishing them. They'll go away. There's something in the canon of the it's kind of like in Thailand it's kind of used like the like a Samanera's catechism sort of thing, where you learn these different fundamental teachings, and it starts with the one thing. What's the one thing? The one thing is that everything is supported by nourishment, and so that everything needs to be fed, and so that that's whether it's a human being, a common animal, or a mental state, a mood, any physical, mental phenomena, it needs to be fed. And pay attention to what you're feeding. Pay attention to what you're nourishing. Because it gains strength when we nourish it. And then when the Buddha talks about the feeding of the hindrances, it's when we give inappropriate attention to something, so that the inappropriate attention say unwise attention, giving unwise attention to the theme of attractiveness. Something's attractive, it's interesting, you look at it, if it's unwise attention, inappropriate attention, then it has that opportunity of feeding sensual desire. And it doesn't mean that you have to say everything's unattractive, everything's ugly. Because that can be inappropriate attention to resistance is the food for ill will. So any kind of resistance, when we're resisting, pushing against, don't like, don't want, giving inappropriate attention to that can be feeding ill will. So the taking an interest, the paying attention to things as a phenomena of nature, is a that's how we understand things. That's how we are able to develop the quality of discernment. But recognizing when do we start dwelling on something unskillfully or inappropriately with our attention? So that sloth and torpor is fed by the inappropriate attention to just sort of how the Buddha put it, something like, you know, there is yawning and drowsiness and heaviness after the meal and sluggishness of awareness, and you start dwelling on that and so, you know, and directing one's attention to it, and then it starts to, that sloth and torpor gains momentum. Giving attention to that, that's something that is the basis of energizing or brightening, or that's has a different result. Restlessness is when we pay attention to the and give attention to when there's some lack of stillness, lack of steadiness, and we that's what we give our attention to. Then it starts to feed and nourish that anxiety, restlessness. And so recognizing that these are natural processes, but we can be plugging in very different ways. Developing a sensitivity to the, you know, what are we feeding and what are we starving if we withhold that attention? And then, of course, we can direct our attention to something more skillful, more wholesome, the feeding of the factors of awakening. The Buddha gives the seven factors of awakening: mindfulness, investigation of dhammas, investigation of states, looking at things, investigating, taking interest, effort, energy, applying our effort, joy, kind of a joy, an exhilaration, a sense of, you know, this is an awakening factor. That tranquility or serenity, samadhi or stability, steadiness of mind, and equanimity as the last factor. Those are qualities that of mind that we can be paying attention to. And those are qualities that we've all experienced in one way, shape, or form or another. And it's when we are willing to feed it, to nourish it, to look after it, then it grows, it gets stronger. So that mindfulness factor is supporting awareness, supporting attention, placing importance on it, recognizing its importance, taking an interest in the investigation and contemplation, not in a like an overly obsessive a restless way, but the Buddha's teachings are really they're really support the development of a discernment actually in the early days, very early days of the Buddha's dispensation, his teaching was characterized as a teaching of analysis and discernment. Many of the movement of the disciples of the Buddha were called Vibhajavadins, and the followers of a teaching of discernment and analysis. So that was a characteristic of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha didn't just rely on a fatalism or a burning up of things through ascetic practices, like they say the fire worshippers. His was a teaching that emphasized that analysis, a measured investigation of one's existence and what one experienced, and through that one was able to ground oneself in a clear understanding. So that directing attention and whenever we're feeding a particular factor of awakening, one has to pay attention to the result. In the same way that if you're eating and you're eating the wrong things, it gives you indigestion. If you eat too much, you feel stuffed and awful. So that the same with that, the different factors of awakening, and you're feeding them. And if it's say with investigation of dhammas, you can get agitated by it, in the sense of you fill your mind up with too much information sometimes, and that's or it's just creating a restlessness, so that you have to pay attention to the result. The Buddha himself didn't say that these are qualities that are always going to result in some positive outcome. There's a discourse where the Buddha points to. He gives the image of fire, and said, and if you've got a large fire and you want to put it out, you don't want to put on more dry wood, more grass, more. Throw on a bit of gasoline, it's going to blaze up and get out of control. So in the same way, if the mind is already agitated, then you don't want to be doing a whole lot of investigation or putting forth effort or putting a lot of attention onto aspects of rapture and joy. It's going to end up agitating oneself. One has to pay attention to the other spectrum of those factors of awakening, those factors of tranquility, serenity. And the tranquility, the word pasati in Pali is it points more to a tranquility of course, obviously of mind, but also a tranquility within the body, There's a deep settling and relaxation of the body, and there's a tranquility that cools and settles everything down. The aspects of samadhi, of that firm establishing of the mind, the steady ability to sustain attention, and equanimity, that evenness of mind. If you've got a big fire blazing, those are the qualities you want to be putting on. And in the mind, when it's a bit agitated, you want to be paying attention to that. If the mind is sluggish, and we experience both. If the mind is sluggish, you don't want to be, how do I become more tranquil? How do I become more settled? How do I become equanimous with it? It'll put you to sleep real quick. So you need to be paying more attention to the qualities of investigation of dhammas. Dhamma vichaya, investigation of dhammas, investigation of phenomena, application of energy, joy, rapture. Those are the kind of exhilaration of the mind. Bhiti is kind of a mental quality of exhilaration, zest. So those are, when there's some sluggishness happening, those are the factors of awakening you want to be attending to. And the Buddha said that he left out mindfulness in both of those. He said, you can never have too much mindfulness in whatever situation. You always want to be applying mindfulness, applying awareness. So that attending to those factors of awakening, paying attention to the balance, and recognizing that those are balancing qualities. Mindfulness, investigation of Dhamma, effort, joy, rapture, tranquility. Samadhi and equanimity. Those are those seven factors of awakening, and they're very helpful tools. Because sometimes it is important to recognize and understand how to undermine and relinquish the hindrances. But it's also important how to encourage the mind, how to brighten the mind. I can remember when early years of being a monk and meditating, it didn't matter when I meditated and practiced, if I investigated the five hindrances, I could just see them all the time. And so that was, sometimes that becomes an overwhelming perception. Oh God, it's just this endless, unrelenting hindrances. And of course that is inappropriate attention, feeding in that way. So you need to learn how to feed those factors of awakening, learning how to encourage them, give them strength. And it's by our directing of attention that's accomplished. In all of these, it's a learning how to pay attention, to take an interest, to discern what's happening, what's the result what is the, because sometimes we're, you know, it's easy to think that if we just sat long enough, then we would get the results we want. If we just and you know, to a certain degree, it's true, you know, in the sense that we want to be persistent and diligent in practice, but that aspect of seeing clearly is what really gives the flavor of the Buddhist teachings. So that learning how to encourage ourselves in ways that we're fostering that quality of really seeing clearly, seeing what our experience is, not shying away from difficult states or just trying to gloss over things that are difficult. But it's just seeing in reality, what's the effect? How's it work? One time, just a few years ago, I took Ajahn Liam, who is the current abbot of Wat Bopong. He's Ajahn Chah's successor. He was visiting, the last time he visited, actually, Abhaya Giri. Took him over to visit the city of 10,000 Buddhas, which is just outside of Ukiah, a Chinese Mahayana monastery. And the abbot there, Reverend Hung Lu, received us, and we're sitting and talking, and Reverend Hung Lu asked Ajahn Liam, you know, what was the most difficult or the hardest thing you've had to deal with in your meditation practice? And Ajahn Liam, there was a, you know, like a substantial pause where he was, and just reflected on that. And then he replied, he said, well, probably fear would have been the hardest thing to deal with. That was probably the most difficult thing I dealt with in my practice. He said, but you can't really look at it in that way, in terms of, you know, hard or difficult. So you just have to look at things as being worthy opponents, and it's those things that are hard and difficult that are actually the cause for our growing in wisdom. Those are the things that give us the opportunity to grow and mature in our wisdom. And then Reverend Hung Lu asked him, well, what was the happiest times in your practice? And Lumpa Liam just immediately sort of asked, oh, so the happiest times are always when I do anything rooted and grounded in selflessness. It was just, didn't have to think about that. It was that coming back to that fundamental selfless nature, and those are the happiest times. So that I think that's a really helpful reflection for us, in the sense of, you know, yeah, there's always going to be some kind of difficulty, something that's a bit hard to deal with, but to recognize that that's an opportunity for our understanding and growing in our discernment and wisdom, and it's also something that can shift very quickly when we're able to relinquish and drop the grip of self. That's where we'll experience the happiest times of our practice. So I'll offer that for reflection this morning, and we can just sit a little bit longer. Mm-hmm.